Okay, it's 9 o'clock, so let us begin. Back from Israel safely. I was happy to meet David Eisen. Gets up early to be with us. Came all the way to Beersheba. A few things before we return. If you recall, we're in the middle of Rabbi Moshe Grozinski. We're going to talk today, begin by talking about two important events he was involved in the 1930s. And then towards the end of the 1930s, towards the hearing of the end of his life, the Zionist movement. That's what we're going to focus on today. A few things, though, as always, before we get to what we want to do. Well, we discussed last class a good deal about Chaim Grada. So here is a picture of Chaim Grada. I'm not making it big. I guess the presenter, the tech support maybe is making it big. But there was news recently because his wife passed away a couple weeks ago, and she didn't leave a will. Therefore, because she didn't leave a will, that means that the state comes in and takes control of everything. Now, it turns out that there are many papers and boxes and all sorts of things in Grada's possession. On tech support, can you help me out here? I can't, what I have is a full screen here. Can't make it smaller. There are many papers. She was, as I said, crazy. She didn't let anyone see her things. And therefore, now that she's, fortunately, she passed away, Harvard University and YIVO and two of the place in Amherst, Massachusetts have been called in to examine his archives. Apparently, there is a number of novels, or at least parts of novels, that have never been published, that he wrote, that are there. There could be letters, maybe even stuff from the Chazon Ish, all sorts of stuff that we really have no idea what was in that apartment because she didn't let anyone in. Okay, before I go any further, I can't, tech support, I can't see anything here. I can't see who's on. All I see is the major screen. In fact, I'm not even sure if anyone's hearing me now, right? So is it possible to fix that? Okay, I fixed it. Now I see everyone. I realize I'm being heard. So as I said, hopefully we'll get some exciting news about Chaim Grada's literary legacy. In Tablet Magazine last week, Alan Nadler had a nice article about his relationship with Chaim Grada. I'll get to your question in a minute, Shlomo. A few more things I want to show you. We spoke about going on the Kotel, on the Temple Mount. Look at this picture. As far as I know, this is the first example of Haredim, of Haredim going on the Temple Mount. Obviously, this is not the mainstream view, and even in the Haredi world, you'll have a few people who are eccentric, but what this shows you is that there's room for even Haredim to move in this direction. All it will be one Hasidish Rebbe, let's say the Belzer Rebbe. If the Belzer Rebbe or the Gera Rebbe declares that it's permissible, then the whole thing will break down, just like you saw with the Erev in Brooklyn. Show you another thing. Talk for a minute about one of the most interesting things to happen in years. With regard to Rav Kook, and I think you'll find it interesting, so let me share it with you. About a week and a half ago, I received a PDF file, right before I went to Israel, like 3 days before I went to Israel, a PDF file with a book of over 200 pages, and this is the title page. I don't have the bottom. It says published in 2009, so that's over a year ago, I never heard of this. I didn't know what this was. A friend of mine had received it in Jerusalem, and he had been told in the email that he should send it out to everyone he can. He didn't know why it was being sent to him. It turns out after he sent it out, he had then got a letter from a lawyer saying he couldn't send it out to anyone else again. What this is, and I won't send it to anyone because I don't know about the morality or even the legality of sending it out, although it can be found on numerous websites. There's been a lot of discussion about it. This is a work from Rav Kook, he was still in Europe, a Mola Nevuchim, as it were, from Rav Kook. It's his early writings. Apparently, Someone got a hold of the file and sent it out improperly. I don't know what the ethics are. I certainly don't think there's a problem reading it. I have it now. I read it. I think there's probably a problem sending it out because the person worked. He had to transcribe it, and he worked hard. And I don't think he plans on censoring it, although you never know. It's important to keep track of it. But this is, another, as I said, if you've read the Shmona Kvatzim, you know how Rav Kook writes. This is very similar. On the blog Ishim B'Shitos, there's a translation of a chapter. There's been a number of discussions of it. I'm going to write a lengthy post dealing with what's in here because, coincidentally, the material that I wrote about a few weeks ago about Rav Kook and sacrifices, you find this in here as well, including what I said that you don't find anywhere else about the Rav Kook's notion that the Sanhedrin would create new drashot to change laws. I was told that it's in here. I haven't found it yet. I've only read about 50 pages. And already I see some very provocative stuff about gratitude to other religions, all sorts of things. So while it's true that there doesn't seem to be anything new, at least I haven't found anything really new so far, the way it's formulated is very interesting and I think even different than what he does elsewhere. Already the Merkaz people have begun their defense that this is Rav Kook's Gullus writings, the writings he wrote before he came to the land of Israel. So therefore, you shouldn't take it as seriously. You've never read Rav Kook. All I can say is there's nothing like him in terms of the power of his writing. One or two more things I want to get to. I had told you about this journal that appears, Iturei Yerushalayim, by Yeshiva Ateret Kohanim. And I saw in the latest issue, or not exactly by now, it's not the latest issue, they refer to what Rav Tzvi Yehuda said that we discussed a couple times, that Rav Tzvi Yehuda says that the Chazon Ish was not the Gadol Hador. He says the Gadol Hador was his father, Rav Kook, and he goes on downgrading the significance of the Chazon Ish, which I mentioned was important for the religious Zionist world because they want to show that their approach is the most proper approach. But here they bring down Rav Avraham Shapiro, who points out his opinion, or Tzvi Yehuda meant by this, was not to degrade Rav Kook in any way. Actually, it's not Rav Avram Shapiro. He says, what's both Rav Avram Shapiro and Yaakov Ariel? It's a combination. Their point, basically, is that what Rav Tzvi Yehuda meant is that to be the Gadol Hador, you need to be a Rav, practicing Rav, that you need to be the person who takes responsibility for their decisions, that there's people who rely on you. That is, you have a kehila. The Chazon Ish didn't have a kehila. He was simply an individual. And therefore, he was simply like a Talmud Chacham who's independent. But the Gadol Hador has to be someone, and Rav Avraham Shapiro, what they quote Rav Avraham Shapiro is saying, is that when you look at the great Rabbanim in the land of Israel, Rav Yitzchak Frank, Rav Reuven Katz and the rest, those who had the responsibility of Hora'ah, of deciding Halacha, they all supported the Heter Mechira. The Chazon Ish and others who didn't have people relying upon them in that same way because they were individual Talmidei Chachamim, they were the Machmirim. So at least that's how Rav Tzvi Yehuda explains it. And finally, we're almost at 10 after, one of you has been listening to old talks and with regard to what we spoke about the Chavetz Chaim last time, and you asked me about, is it true what I said or what the source is that I said that in the Radin Yeshiva, Chafetz Chaim's own yeshiva, they didn't wear their tzitzis out, even though the Chafetz Chaim himself says that you have to wear tzitzis out. And again, we discussed what the Chafetz Chaim means by that. I told you that what Rav Abadi said, that he's not referring to wearing tzitzis out like you do in yeshivas today. He's referring to people who wear the tzitzis like over their garment, like you see Sidim and others do. But in any event, the general minhag, the general practice among certain yeshiva people is to wear it out. This is recorded in numerous places, including by Talmidim of the Chafetz Chaim. I didn't have time, from the time I was contacted right before the show, I didn't have time to get the books, but if you email me, I can send you the references, but I'll give you something better than this. It's not just that in the Radin Yeshiva, they didn't follow the Chafetz Chaim's views in the Mishnah Berura. The Chafetz Chaim himself, in his own actions, did not always follow what he wrote in the Mishnah Berura. And I'll just give you one example. There's a biography, a five-volume biography called Me'ir Eimei Yisrael. It has all sorts of material about the Chafetz Chaim, interviews, many students. It's full of interesting stuff. And if you look in volume 1, page 60, they quote his son-in-law, Rabbi Zaks, who actually taught at YU. He was the Bochrein that she was with Yitzhak Hanan for many years. And just to give you one example, and this is not the only one, he reports that the Chavetz Chaim did not make a bracha on the Tefillin Shel Rosh. This is a really dispute generally between Ashkenazim and Sfaradim. Ashkenazim make the bracha on the Tefillin Shel Rosh. Sfaradim don't. But the Chavetz Chaim did not. Why he did not, it's not 100% clear. There's discussion of it. But in the Mishnah Berurah, he decides that you should, as the Ashkenazim Posek should decide, that you should make the bracha. And yet, here you have an example, and as I said, there's other examples as well, where the Chavetz Chaim personally did not do even what he postens that people should do in the Mishnah Berurah. And he's not the only one. Shulchan Aruch HaRav records certain things as halacha in his Shulchan Aruch, and we know that he personally did not do it. Shlomo. The Moshe Soloveitchik was Mizrahi. It is true. He didn't just teach the Tachamoni. He actually went to the Mizrahi convention and spoke there. But to say he was Mizrahi, I don't know if you can say he was Mizrahi. He wasn't a part-time Mizrahi member. He didn't like Agudas Yisrael, that's for sure, but it's not like he was an official member of Mizrahi, although he did regard himself in some sense as a spiritual leader for those people who associated with Mizrahi because they didn't feel comfortable with Aguda, but I wouldn't say that he was actually like his son, a Karkan Mizrahi member. I don't know what his relationships was with his brother. What we have, the reports of it, was that the relationships was always good. Ravelvo came to Warsaw and they got together, and the family doesn't say anything negative about Ramosha Soloveitchik if you read the Brisker literature. I can't say. I mean, there's always been a little bit of discussions, maybe a little bit of tension. Ramosha Soloveitchik was older. Why didn't he get the Rabbonus and Brisk? We can talk about that maybe at another time. So then you say, why did the Rav join the American Aguda, not the Mizrahi? Well, first of all, Rav Soloveitchik was his own person. And as I said, his father wasn't really Mizrahi. Having said that, the family was not Aguda either. So why did he join Aguda? I don't know if it's ever been explained 100%. When the Rav joined Aguda, all the other great rabbis in America were almost exclusively, with the exception of Eliezer Silver, they were almost all Mizrahi. So it would have been normal for the Rav to be Mizrahi. He joins Aguda, I guess he believed in the ideology, both the non-Zionist ideology as well as the view of, of Gedolei Yisrael, that they should make the rules. Let's not forget that the Rav was not really such a Zionist then, so if you were not really a Zionist, you would not be a Mizrahi. When I say Ramosha Soloveitchik was associated with Mizrahi, there's no evidence that he was a Zionist. It's just that he had problems with Aguda, so the Mizrahi was the other religious organization. So he was involved in a certain way with them. But there's no evidence that he had any Zionist feelings whatsoever, so he wasn't a real Mizrahi. The same thing with Soloveitchik. Certainly before the war, there's no evidence of any Zionist feeling, so you're not going to be involved with Mizrahi. And even after the war, his Zionism is a very lukewarm Zionism. Okay, let's return now to Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. I ended last class with the discussion of the Shlita issue in Germany, how this was not a local issue, this was a national issue. Rav Chaim Moser actually told Rabbi Chaya Yaakov Weimer to prepare a responsum about the halakhic permissibility of stunning before Shlita. There were others who didn't even want to examine the issue. He said that we just have to give up meat, that is, the Jews of Germany. One of these was Rabbi Chanan Wasserman, who was the brother-in-law of Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski. Another was Rav Aaron Cutler. These two, Rabbi Chanan Wasserman and Rav Aaron Cutler, were on issue after issue the most extreme of the Lithuanian Rosh Yeshiva. I've already mentioned that these were the two leaders of in the Aguda who wanted to officially oppose the creation of a state, a Jewish state. And in this matter, they didn't want to have any discussions about this. They even thought, because for people like Chaim Moser, at the very least, if you find a heter, even if it's a questionable heter, for those people who have to eat meat, in those days, the doctors would often say that elderly people need to eat meat. At least it's better for them to eat meat from stunning, which is a questionable heter, rather than to eat meat, which it doesn't have any stunning at all. Okay, I don't know if the people are seeing this, but my picture keeps getting bigger, so I'm going to lower it again. I can't see anything here. Okay, there I am. They thought it was better for the people if they had to eat meat to eat actual treif, because they thought that even going to this issue, even trying to discuss the issue of stunning animals before shechita, would open up a whole can of worms. But Rav Chaim Moser did not think so. He thought that if it could be proven that stunning animals before shechita is halachically permissible, and by the way, New Zealand just officially banned shechita. That's Scandinavia, and now we have New Zealand. So Rav Chaim Moser said, told Rav Chaim Weimer to prepare a responsum, and he did. And it was an important issue because there were many non-Orthodox Jews who, if given the choice between no meat or non-kosher meat, would eat non-kosher meat. So at least from Rabbi Chiyak of Weimar's perspective, and Rav Chaim Moser agreed in early 1933, it was important to see if you could have a halachically permissible approach. However, Rav Chaim Moser soon changed his position. And if you read my book in chapter 5 on Rabbi Weimar, you see I discuss this in great detail. I'll summarize it here. This is all happening in 1933. As soon as the Nazis came to power, they banned shechita. Within 2 months of coming to power, they banned shechita. By the way, meat could be imported, but it was expensive, and meat had been imported in Switzerland from France and from Germany, but it was very difficult and expensive to import meat. Rav Chaim Moser, later in 1933, after a few months, declares that no matter what Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg concludes, and no matter what the tests, because they actually, there was a doctor, an Orthodox doctor named Lieben in Prague, and he was carrying out all sorts of tests with stunning animals, because what it comes down to is if you could show that if the animal is stunned and it doesn't really affect the internal organs or anything like that, then there's room. It's as if you're putting the animal to sleep by giving the animal some chloroform or something like that. Then there's no problem shechting it. Rav Chaim Moser, though, changes his mind, and he tells Rabbi Weinberg that you should stop the tests. There is no way we can ever permit stunning animals before shechita. So why would Rav Chaim Moser change his mind? I'm telling Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg to write this responsum after expressing hope that there could find permission could be found. Rabbi Weinberg thought that there was a few reasons. First of all, Rav Chaim Moser saw that in the rest of Europe, shechita was threatened. Poland. And if permission was given in Germany to permit stunning, then the governments of these countries, maybe even Hungary as well, would be able to argue that the stunning is really not halakhically impermissible, and therefore they could institute a decree against for stunning in their countries as well. Rabbi Weinberg also mentions that Rav Chaim Moser was put under great pressure by other rabbis in Eastern Europe. Rabbi Weinberg says that they flooded Rav Chaim Moser with telegrams and letters, especially the Hasidische rabbi. Hasidische rebbes were very opposed to any sort of discussion of changing the traditional Jewish practice. And therefore, Rav Chaim Moser, and I guess you could say, caved to this pressure, or he was led to conclude that the others were correct, that there was all... I mean, there was meta halachic reasons also. To change the traditional Jewish method of shechita would be to acknowledge that it was a cruel and inhumane method of shechita, or that it would cave into the demands of the anti-Semites. The funny thing was that after Rav Chaim Moser gave his decision, basically his non-decision, that we're not going to examine this anymore, and he tells Rabbi Weinberg, who had written a long, almost a volume, which was published in Sridiation Volume 1, about the permission to shecht animals, he tells Weinberg not to publish it, and Weinberg, as they say, received schar of aprisha. He only published it after the war, but there were still rabbis in Germany who thought that maybe Weinberg would independently issue a heter. But if you knew Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, you knew that when Rav Chaim Moser Grzinski said to him, this cannot happen, that he would fall into line, as he did. He was upset. He thought that that he had proven that stunning was permissible, and that he didn't want all these non-Orthodox Jews in Germany to start eating non-kosher. He had a sense, whereas the separatist community in Germany, the Frankfurt rabbis, their concern was not with the non-Orthodox. They didn't care about them. Therefore, they didn't want to change Jewish practice in order to make life easier for those whose commitment was not absolute. People like the Chiyak of Weinberg and others had a much more of a Klal Yisrael sensibility. Weinberg writes that Rabbi Chaim Ozer told all the Gedolim, all the great rabbis of Eastern Europe, not to reply to Weinberg, not even to deal with him. They have something to say to go through Rabbi Chaim Ozer. And this was all part of the effort to make sure that a heter would not come out. And as I said, I'm doing this very quickly, but that was the first great dispute in the 1930s where Rabbi Chaim Ozer used his international influence, I guess that's the way to put it, to shut down any discussion, and no Rav could shut down discussion of this issue except for Rabbi Chaim Ozer. They shut it down. I mean, shut it down internationally. The next issue, which came very shortly after this, within a year, where Chaim Ozer again used his influence, and in this way, I think from the perspective of 60 years later, 70 years later, at least from my perspective, this was influence of Chaim Ozer here, and the significance of his decision was actually in a negative way. And let me explain what I mean. With the Nazi rise to power, it was clear that there was no future for the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. The Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, which we've spoken about so many times, institution designed to train rabbis in Torah in Derech Eretz philosophy, go out into the modern world to meet the challenges, and they never viewed themselves as only an institution for German rabbis. They viewed themselves as an institution for rabbis all throughout Europe, even America, any rabbi who was interested in that sort of perspective. But since no one was from the outside were going to be coming to Germany anymore, no one from Eastern Europe, and even German Jews were interested in leaving, Mayor Hildesheimer, the son of Israel Hildesheimer, the founder of it, began planning to the land of Israel. The land of Israel only had a few great yeshivas at this time. They had Merkas Harav, which was fairly new. The Hebron yeshiva had been there. Those were the only real, significant yeshivas. You had a number of small yeshivas, but the Chaim yeshiva didn't really have people much, more of a high school. So it was really Hebron and Merkas. And this would be a new institution. Why to go to the land of Israel? Well, first of all, where else are you going to go? You're going to go to Italy? You're going to go to America? Well, why would, as long as you have to leave Germany, what Jew doesn't want to live in the land of Israel? Even Mayor Hildesheimer, who is an Agudist, but the land of Israel is the Holy Land. Also, as he explained, the land of Israel needed modern rabbis. There was an enormous culture gap. You had the old-time rabbis, who had no secular education, and then you had the secular leadership. There was no one to bridge the gap. It's not an accident that many, many children of the religious ended up becoming non-religious. Either you joined the Haganah, or before the Haganah, you joined one of the non-Orthodox Zionist movements, or you remained like in the shtetl, which was the land of Israel in those days. You didn't have any sort of modern orthodoxy. So how to keep the young, how to keep people who wanted to have careers, who wanted to, I guess, enter the big world, because the land of Israel was changing. Aliyah was increasing, and therefore the thought was to create a modern Orthodox rabbinical institution that would appeal to German immigrants, immigrants who no longer wanted to live the more of the shtetl type existence, which was fine, and that's the way life had been in the land of Israel for so long, but things were changing. So it made perfect sense. The Chaim Ozer Gerzinski, however, and by the way, Mayor Hildesheimer actually went. Spoke to Rav Kook. Rav Kook actually gave his approval, but not in Jerusalem. He said, Jerusalem has the old-fashioned, old-time yeshivas, but Tel Aviv, the modern city, your institution could do wonders there. So he comes back to Germany, and he's all set. Now, they knew this plan would meet with opposition from the more extreme Orthodox, especially in the land of Israel. That's one of the reasons why they wouldn't go to Jerusalem. Because they didn't want to meet with the opposition of the Eda Charedit, which was the officially Aguda, but they would have opposed this. They never expected that Rav Chaim Ozer Gerzinski would be opposed. Oh, Rav Chaim Ozer Gerzinski was the recognized Gödel, the recognized leader of Orthodoxy, not just of Lithuanian Orthodoxy. In Germany, they looked towards him. And as we just saw, when it came to the Shlita issue, they looked towards him. Lithuania had all sorts of Jews in Lithuania. You had Mizrahi, as we mentioned, the Marcheses, Revigus was Mizrahi on his base. In Kovno, you had a very moderate rabbi named Rav Avraham Shapiro. You had a Tarim Derech Eretz type of Orthodoxy that had recently taken root. In Lithuania, the Kovno Rav was the spiritual leader of it. Rav Chaim Moser never expressed any opposition to this. He had friends and colleagues of all sorts, secularly educated. Dov Zakheim, you know Dov Zakheim, former high official in the Defense Department. Rabbi Dov Zakheim, his father, who was also very secularly educated, was one of Rav Chaim Moser's secretaries in Vilna. And so there was, no one would have expected that Rav Chaim Moser would have any position to this. So there's room for the yeshivas, and there's also room for the rabbinical seminary. And yet, when news of the prospective transfer to the land of Israel became known, Rav Chaim Moser began to take steps, strong steps, to oppose this. And he begins writing letters, not only to Meir Hildesheimer, but to Rav Kook and Reuven Katz, who was the Rav of Petach Tikva, to his student, Rav Amiel, who was the Rav of Tel Aviv, and many others. He writes, and this is a very famous letter, he writes to Meir Hildesheimer saying that your father was a great tzaddik. He knew what the problems were in the West, especially in Germany. And therefore, as an emergency measure, he established this rabbinical seminary of Berlin, which has done wonders to fight with reform and to spread Orthodoxy in Germany, and it's a vital institution, but only in Germany. He says there in the land of Israel, there are old-fashioned yeshivas there. The people are living a traditional lifestyle. There is no need for what he termed a rabbi factory. Very negative term, as we'll see what Weinberg's response to this is. He said that at the end of the day, the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin is a rabbi factory. That means designed to produce rabbis. Traditional yeshiva was not designed to produce rabbis. It was designed for people who would sit for 10 years, 15 years, 5 years, however long, just to learn. That was the point. And then afterwards, if you become a rabbi, you become a rav. Many people do not become rabbani. But to have an institution designed to produce rabbis, to have an institution that trains people in pedagogy, expects them to get a secular education, this is fitting for the Jews of Western Europe. It is not at all fitting for the Jews of the land of Israel and their Sephardim living there. Rav Chaim Moser affirms and reaffirms the need for old-time yeshivas in the land of Israel. There's this great fear, you've seen this over and over again, I've spoken about this in the past, that as soon as an institution like the rabbinical seminary arrives in the land of Israel, it will destroy the old-time yeshivas. All the people who are studying in the yeshivas will decide they want to go to the rabbinical seminary in Berlin. You see that there was no confidence in the old way. That confronted with the rabbinical seminary, that the yeshivas wouldn't be able to deal with it. They wouldn't be able to hold their own. Look how different things are today. Today, the yeshivas, they are more than holding their own. We spoke in the past about Rabbi Dessler's opposition to an institution that also teaches secular studies. He was literally afraid that the yeshivas in England, the parents wouldn't want their kids to go there anymore. How different is that today when you have all these great yeshivas and you also have the institutions like YU and the Bar Ilan Kollel and all these other places, Machon Lev, and no one in the Haredi world seems to be afraid that the chairs are going to empty out. But that was Rav Chaim Moser's great fear. He also mentioned that there's no reform menace in the land of Israel. Since there's no reform menace, therefore, we don't need a rabbinical seminary of Berlin. He didn't have any appreciation, I would say, for the needs of the younger generation. And really, the result of all this, and we'll go through the story briefly, is obviously the rabbinical seminary did not move there. But what this meant was that for close to 50 years, there was really no movement in terms of developing a modern Orthodox rabbinate in the land of Israel. And throughout the 40s, the 50s, the 60s, the 70s, into the 1980s, all you had were these old-time rabbis who could not relate to the younger generation. It's no accident that there was traction for traditional Judaism. Now you have the SOAR movement, and you have others. But that was a real problem. And obviously, I'm not blaming Rafai Moser in the sense that he did anything, quote, wrong. But if you look at it historically, and this is something that the German Orthodox always thought, the fact that Rafaim Ozer was successful in this ended up, unfortunately, creating a situation where Orthodoxy developed in a very stunted fashion. You had the Haredi Orthodoxy, and really, that, and then you had the Mizrahi type of Orthodoxy, but you never had, even their rabbis were, for the most part, of the old-fashioned type of rabbis. You never developed an intellectual Orthodoxy. An Orthodoxy where the rabbis were in tune with the broader humanistic trends, who were secularly educated, and there was obviously a need for that. Today you have these types of rabbis, but you didn't have it for many years. And so let's return to the story here. Actually, Bill, that's not true. He used it in the letter. I don't know, what's your, so why do you say that? No, that Schneier Lyman is absolutely incorrect. This claim was made by Mayor Hildesheimer, who's probably, it's incorrect. They have the letters, but that's not what they said about it. They have the letter, they look, they'll see it. Mayor Hildesheimer made this claim that did not use this. Maybe in one of the letters he wrote to him he didn't, but he definitely used it in other letters. And the reason we know this is because I have Mayor Hildesheimer's response to Rafaim Moser Brzezinski. I published it in my doctoral dissertation. And you see from that he used it because Mayor Hildesheimer was responding to him. I asked Mayor Hildesheimer about this, if I recall, and because in the letters of Rafaim Moser Brzezinski addressed to Mayor Hildesheimer, he uses this exact expression. And Mayor Hildesheimer, in a an article, said that... I'll bring it in next time. He said that it's not true, that he used it, but he wasn't saying that based upon the actual letter. And Mayor Hildesheimer responds to Rafaim Moser, and he responds to Rafaim Moser's use of the term Beit Charosh Rabbanim. But I will, I'll get the details. Hold on, let me get a note for myself. I remember I investigated this. It was right in my doctoral dissertation years ago, and there was no evidence whatsoever that even in the letter to Mayor Hildesheimer, this was taken out. I'll bring in the evidence next week. That appears to me, even though it was stated by Mayor Hildesheimer, the grandson, it appears to be incorrect. It could be in one letter left it out, but I remember when I investigated it, the letter, the famous one, that's... addressed to him, it appears, I am certain that it was there. I'll bring in all the evidence, including next week, of the letter that Mayor Hildesheimer wrote back to him. Unless you want to say that Mayor Hildesheimer was responding to that he heard he used it. But all I can say is that I remember, I can't remember the details now, but I remember when I asked Mayor Hildesheimer why he said that, he didn't tell me because it's in the original letter. He gave some other sort of explanation that, like, he never would have written that way to my grandfather or something like that. But I remember that I was not at all convinced because there was actually no evidence. And he said, when I asked him about, do you have the actual letter, is in the letter, he did not say that he had it in the letter. So, but as I said, I will go back to my notes. I'll take a look. In my doctoral dissertation, I have the three letters that Mayor Hildesheimer sent to Rafaim Ozer about this. So pick up on it. Okay, but thank you for mentioning that. I will pick up on that next class. In this letter, by the way, that he wrote to Mayor Hildesheimer, Rafaim Moser says to him, although we're friends, thank you, Charles, but I know he responds to use of the term, but the question was, is he responding to use of the term in the letter that Rafaim Moser wrote to him, or is he just saying he heard that he uses this expression, Beit Charosh, I believe it's, I have to check the dates of the letter of Rafaim Moser. I believe it's in that exact letter. He's responding to the exact letter. And I remember, like I said, all I remember that when I spoke to Mayor Hildesheimer, he didn't tell me that they have the original letter. He didn't tell me that at all. He said he had some other reason for it. But I'll bring in next class the source. It's in this book, Tarim Derech Eretz, where Mayor Hildesheimer makes this claim. Yeah, I'll bring it in all next week. By the way, he used the same expression about the Tachkamoni. He has a letter to Mayor Bar Ilan, who's ahead of Mizrahi, and he refers to the Tachkamoni in Wurzler, Moshe Soloveitchik taught as a Beis Harosh at Rabbanim. So he obviously liked that expression. Now, if you look at the Mayor Hildesheim, at Israel Hildesheimer's opening lecture, inaugural address to the opening at Rabbinical Seminary, which I published in English translation in the Ramada Journal a number of years ago, Israel Hildesheimer says specifically that this is not going to be, we do not want this to be, a rabbi factory. So it's ironic that Rav Chaim Moser refers to it as a rabbi factory, and it's obviously a derogatory expression. Hildesheimer said this is going to be a center of intellectual life, of Jewish intellectual life, not a rabbi factory. So Rav Chaim Moser writes to him and says, although I love you, the truth is to be loved above all else. And he let Mayor Hildesheimer know that he was not going to back down. He was going to basically force the issue and make sure that the rabbinical seminary is not transferred to the land of Israel. This shows you the great power of Chaim Moser Lipinski. Mayor Hildesheimer is living in Germany. It's German Orthodoxy. He can do what he wants to do. He's in charge of the rabbinical seminary in Berlin. Plenty of people wanted to move it. Why does he have to listen to a rabbi in Vilna? We don't have rabbis like this today. Moshe Feinstein or Rav Shach would say that this institution shouldn't open in the land of Israel. People wouldn't listen to it. You think why you would listen to them? They do what they want to do. This shows you the power. And it wasn't the power in the sense that Rav Chaim Moser had any sort of physical control, but it was the power of his personality. As you would say, of his godless, that no one would cross him. You can disagree with Rav Chaim Moser, that's fine. But Rav Chaim Moser puts his foot down and says, this you cannot do. They would not cross him. They would not disagree with him. But you see also in this the letter of Rav Chaim Moser is his total opposition to Torah and Derech Eretz. That it's only suitable for Eastern, for German Orthodoxy. It's just German Orthodoxy is really sick. That they're ill. They've been infected with secular culture and there's Reform Judaism and all that. Therefore, in Germany, this is an okay approach. But God forbid to bring it to the land of Israel. He actually says that it is, quote, planting a fallen plant in the vineyard of the house of Israel in the Holy Land, planting there the German culture, which has already struck many dead. And we saw what it brought them. That is, if you go to the land of Israel and you bring Torah and Derech Eretz there, which is what the rabbinical seminary is, you'll be responsible for the destruction of many people. They're going to be led astray. From Mayor Hildesheimer's perspective, it's just the opposite. They're going to save Orthodoxy there. He writes to Rav Chaim Moser that take a look at how powerful Torah and Derech Eretz is, that we were able to stop the hemorrhaging of German Orthodoxy. And he says, look at other countries who've adopted this. But Rav Chaim Moser thought it would be very negative. By the way, speaking of Torah and Derech Eretz, just today, the translation which I published of Hirsch's famous Schiller speech, in which he declared his great admiration for the poet Schiller, a speech which has never appeared in English until today. It was posted for a Ramada Journal. It was posted at YU Torah. You can look at it. This is a speech which, for good reason, was never published. Right before, well, when we got it into press, before it appeared, we were contacted. Someone in the Washington Heights community contacted us and said that the reason they never published it was not because it supported Torah and Derech Eretz, but because people would be upset to see how Hirsch, people after the Holocaust, that is, would be very upset to see how Hirsch idealized culture, and that's why they refused to publish it. I don't know if that's any less of a censorship, but still censorship. Be that as it may, I invite everyone to read Hirsch's famous Schiller speech. And it's that sort of thing that Rav Chaim Moser does not want in the land of Israel. And Rav Chaim Moser doesn't just write to Hildesheimer. As I said, he starts writing to rabbis all over. In fact, Reuven Katz, the famous Degel Reuven, who was a rav in Bayonne, New Jersey, before going to Petach Tikva, if you know Passaic, his son was a rabbi in Passaic. He had another son who was also a rav in Petach Tikva, and he had another son, Dr. Abraham Katz, who was at Dropsy College in Philadelphia for many years, but Reuven Katz, he wrote an article, and there was a newspaper called Hahed. Hahed was very much a Zionist type of Orthodox newspaper. I wouldn't say it was Mizrahi, but it was an Aguda. as I said, you have all these rabbis who in chutzah aretz would have been very happy to be an aguda, but when they go to the land of Israel and they see what the aguda, who's running the aguda in the land of Israel, they basically have nothing to do with aguda. They're not involved with Mizrahi either. They're just, look, Rav Kook was not Mizrahi either. Rav Kook, there was a whole school of people who supported Zionism of a sort, who were not involved in political Zionism. Reuven Katz was one of them. And he publishes an article in which he goes through numerous reasons why it's very dangerous to move the rabbinical seminary of Berlin to Germany, I mean to Palestine. Both Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg and Meir Hildesheimer responded very sharply to Chaim Ozer. Yes, you're right. He passed away a couple of years ago, or Michal Katz. Not only was he Rosh Yeshiva at YU, he also wrote a doctoral dissertation there on the Chasam Sofer. It was one of the first books written on a Chasam Sofer. Today, you would not regard this as first level of scholarly books dealing with the Chasam Sofer, but it has a lot of good information, and it was really the first biography of the Chasam Sofer, so it has to get credit for that. Weinberg writes to Rav Chaim Ozer, and Weinberg says to Rav Chaim Ozer, first of all, I also oppose moving Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, but I don't have time now to explain why. So I don't think there's any question that his reason for opposing moving it is because he was confident that German Orthodoxy would continue in Germany, and this was only a stage, that is the Hitler era, and that there'd be a need for the Rabbinical Seminary. But Weinberg was very offended by Rav Chaim Ozer's negative comments regarding the Rabbinical Seminary. In my book, in the book I published, Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg's Letters, Volume 2, or Kisvei Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg, I publish Weinberg's letter to Chaim Ozer Grzinski. And it really is an incredible letter. Unfortunately, the book's not yet available on HebrewBooks.org. They're supposed to be putting it up now for many, many months. If you have Ozer HaChachma, I sent it to them, you can see it. But it is an incredible letter. It's been reprinted now numerous times in articles, because here is Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg in a private letter standing up to Rav Chaim Ozer Grzinski as strongly and with as much confidence as really you can imagine. First of all, he doesn't understand why Rav Chaim Ozer speaks so negatively about the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. Yes, Rav Weinberg saw the letter that he wrote to Meir Hildesheimer. All right, that's also William. The letter that mentions Beit Charoshet was the one written to Meir Hildesheimer. And this was the letter then that Weinberg saw. Rav Chaim Ozer did not write a letter to Weinberg about the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. The letter was written to Meir Hildesheimer, and then this was shown to everyone. And in that letter, he speaks about it as a rabbi factory. And Weinberg is offended. Called our institution a rabbi factory? Speak about how we're not a serious place. On the contrary, Weinberg says, it's the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin which has instilled the love of Torah, German Jewry, and not only that, it's influenced many young German Jews to go to the land, to go to Eastern Europe and study at the great yeshivas. Showing his complete identification with the Rabbinical Seminary, Weinberg claims that not only does the seminary glorify God's name, it battles ignorance and heresy with more success than any of the yeshivas in Eastern Europe, be it Lithuania or Poland. And Weinberg says there is no reason why this great influence that we have here in Germany will not continue in the land of Israel. He says, not only are we not a rabbi factory, we are a yeshiva in the full sense of the word. He says that our standards are just as high as those of the East European yeshivas, and not only that, it is harder, he says, to get smicha at the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin than it is to get smicha at Eastern Europe. 6 years. And they were really, what Weinberg says, you know how you get smicha in Eastern Europe? You come, you find a rav there, you talk with him for an hour or two. If he sees you know something, you get smicha. Weinberg says he had people who couldn't get smicha at the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin. They weren't up to the standards, so instead they go to Eastern Europe and get smicha. Now, in his letter, Rav Chaim Ozer had spoken about how the Rabbinical Seminary in Berlin, the students, you know, were told to study secular subjects, and that's not appropriate for the land of Israel. And Weinberg says, what do you mean to study secular subjects? other than Talmud and Palestine, the only quotes secular subjects we do are Bible and Jewish history. And can these really be considered secular? I think, incidentally, that Weinberg misunderstood what Ephraim Moses was saying here. When Ephraim Moses says that rabbinical seminary students study secular studies, he wasn't referring to in the seminary. He's referring to the fact that it was expected as part of the studies at the seminary, they would also go to the German university. But in any event, Weinberg says that we don't study secular subjects. These are horror subjects. Even Jewish history is not, quote, secular. And then Weinberg really, what you call it, a dig, or however you put it, a dig in a positive sense. He says, Ephraim Moser, you are forgetting. You think that you're the leader of East European Orthodoxy. You think you're the leader of the yeshivot, which he was. He was head of this in the body yeshivos. All the money from America came to him, and then he distributed to the yeshivas. So he had a great sense of loyalty to the East European yeshivas, and those were the type of yeshivas in the land of Israel. And he was defending these type of yeshivas against what he thought would hurt them, the rabbinical seminary of Berlin. And Weinberg says to him, you forgot them. You think that you're the head of the East European yeshivas, but really, you're the head of Orthodoxy as a whole. You're also our leader, German Orthodox leader. Therefore, German Orthodoxy's leader. Therefore, Weinberg says, we look to you. You're our leader too. And we expect that you're going to defend us and our institution against its detractors, not to join in them, their derision. In other words, there were plenty of people criticizing the Rabbinical Seminary of Berlin, saying that this is not the real yeshiva and German Orthodoxy is not real Torah Orthodoxy. And you, Ephraim Moser, you are our leader also. And we expect that you're going to defend us. So, here, Ephraim Moser is criticized, but being criticized for not really standing up for what he should be doing. That is, not being parochial, but being the leader of all of Orthodoxy, not just the leader of Orthodoxy. It's an amazing thing to have Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg, who is now part of German Orthodoxy, telling Ephraim Moser, you think you're just the Rav of Lithuania, maybe the leader of Lithuanian Orthodoxy, but you're the God of Hador, and we need you too. So, as I said, that's when you see how Rabbi Yaakov Weinberg writes to Rabbi Moser and how he views him as the leader, it's obvious that when Rabbi Moser said, don't move the seminary or don't, stun before Shlita, they weren't going to dispute with them. Weinberg's criticism of Rabbi Moser is, as I said, only because Rabbi Moser is forgetting his real role, and that's to stand above all these disputes. Hildesheimer's response is obviously different than that of Weinberg's response. Ephraim Moser writes to Hildesheimer, how can you think of embarking on such a plan without consulting the great Torah scholars in the land of Israel and in Europe? And he mentions the Moetzis, the Council of Torah Sages of Agudas Yisrael, because Mayor Hildesheimer was a member of Agudas Yisrael. And Mayor Hildesheimer replies that we did discuss with the Gedolim. He didn't see why he needed to discuss with the Gedolim of Eastern Europe. If he's moving to the land of Israel, why does he need to discuss with them? As I said, he never expected that Rafai Moser would come out against him. He discussed it with Riff Cook, and he discussed it with Shlomo Aronson, who was the chief rabbi of Tel Aviv, and many other rabbis in the land of Israel, and they enthusiastically supported the plan. Despite the great initiative, the plan never came to fruition. In fact, Mayor Hildesheimer died shortly after that in 1934. And Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg writes a very nice eulogy for him. Weinberg, I published one of his letters. He was very upset because he opposed Mayor Hildesheimer. He actually got people on it's called the curatorium, the board of directors, to oppose Mayor Hildesheimer. So even if Ephraim Moser had not been opposition, although Mayor Hildesheimer was the president of the institution, the board of directors would have refused to move it anyway. So then Mayor Hildesheimer dies suddenly, and Weinberg and Hildesheimer were not in the best of terms because of Weinberg's opposition was that the seminary needs to remain here. Jews still need us in Germany. Whatever the case is, Ephraim Moser made sure that even if Mayor Hildesheimer was able to convince members of the board and Rabbi Chiyak of Weinberg to move the seminary, it never would have happened. And then later, 1938, after Kristallnacht, Weinberg himself thought that it's time to move the seminary, but then things happened too fast. Weinberg is expelled from Germany shortly after that, and the seminary closes for Kristallnacht, never to be reopened. There was some talk about restarting it after the war in the Land of Israel in the early 1950s. The Rosh Yeshiva in the Land of Israel were just as opposed to it, and it became part of history. It never existed again after Kristallnacht. Today we can speculate what would have happened had it come to the Land of Israel. There's no question that Orthodoxy in the Land of Israel would have developed it very differently. But it didn't happen. The Chaim Ozer remains really the Gadol Hador, the Gadol certainly of European Jewry throughout the rest of the 1930s. And he dies in the summer of 1940. Vilna, at this time, while it had been part of Lithuania, it had been given back to Lithuania by the Soviet Union, which invaded in September of 1939. It was part of Poland. Then the Soviet Union invades. It takes it over, that part of Poland, and it gives Vilna back to Lithuania. And in June 1940, Vilna is annexed by the Soviet Union. So when Rav Chaim Ozer dies in August 1940, Vilna is under communist control. He did not die. He was not killed in the Holocaust. He had a Jewish funeral. We even have pictures of the funeral. The Nazis do not come into Vilna until June 24th, 1941, a couple days after the invasion of the Soviet Union. And you can visit. Today, you can go to Vilna and visit Rav Chaim Ozer's cemetery. In the 1960s, it was actually Rabbi Teitz from Elizabeth who was responsible for putting up a new tombstone at Rav Chaim Ozer's grave, and other graves as well. Now, all the biographies of Rav Chaim Ozer, none of the biographies of Rav Chaim Ozer really mention anything about what happened to his wife. I assume because they don't know. And yet, I found information, believe it or not. So let me show you where I found information. In general, they don't talk about his wife much in any of the biographies. I don't think I've ever seen a picture of his wife. He had one daughter, incidentally, and the daughter died when she was a teenager. Never again had a child. In fact, I don't remember if, maybe someone can remind me, in the Chaim Grada story that portrays the Rubinstein Rav Chaim Ozer dispute, which Rabbis and Wise, I believe that's what it is. I can't recall, maybe if someone remembers, when he portrays Rav Chaim Ozer, does he portray him as also having a daughter who died young? I'm not mistaken, the daughter, he doesn't portray him that way. He portrays him as having a daughter who's crazy. Teenage girl who's sort of a little mentally off. Unless I'm confusing this with another one of his stories. But if anyone remembers, let me know. There is this book that came out a couple of years ago called Halichos Yisrael. It's Halichos, Halachos, Hanhagos, Hachraos, Beirim, Haros, that were stated from Rabbi Yisrael Zeiv Gusman. Who is Yisrael Zeiv Gusman? He was, as it's described here on the title page, he taught in the Ramalei Yeshiva in Vilna and a dayan on the Beis Din of Rav Chaim Ozer Brzezinski. We've spoken about Rav Gusman in the past. Oh, by the way, one more thing about his wife. His wife was the sister of the wife of Rav Chaim Ozer, Rav Elkanah Wasserman. This is actually the second wife of Rav Chaim Ozer. His first wife died in the 1920s. For his second wife, he married the wife he married was the sister of the wife of Rav Elkanah Wasserman. Their father-in-law was Rav Meir Atlas, the Rav of Shavli in Lithuania. That was the city that Rav Yosef Zecharia Stern, the incredibly great Rav Yosef Zecharia Stern, was also the Rav of. So they were brothers-in-law. This Rav Meir Atlas was not the father of Shmuel Atlas, so the professor at Hebrew Union College that Rebecca Weinberg had so much correspondence with. In the first edition of Making of a Gadol, Kamenetsky identifies Shmuel Atlas as the son of Meir Atlas. And all you have to do is open up the edition of Atlas's edition of the Raivan on Bava Kama, and you see it's dedicated to his parents. The first page, you see he's not the son. I assume it's the same family. Atlas is a big family. There was also an Eliezer Atlas, who was an Orthodox publicist. I told Kamenetsky this, and in the so-called revised edition, or approved edition, whatever he called it, he corrects this mistake. Shmuel Atlas's uncle was Baruch Horovitz, the last Rosh Hashiva of Sabaka. I believe it was his. Maybe I'm confused here. Maybe I think that, yeah, that's his uncle. And he was also related to him, Avram Grzynski, who was the last Mashkiach of the Sabaka Yeshiva killed in the war. Rav Gusman, as I said, we spoke in the famous story about he tells Professor Alman's son, when he visits him on Shiva, his son, Professor Alman's son was killed in the Lebanon War, that Rav Gusman is jealous because his son was just killed during the war, but he wasn't killed fighting for the people as Professor Alman's son was. But he says to him that now your son and my son are greeting each other in Olam Haba. Gusman would, he would go, I mean, the stories are incredible. He'd go to watch the parades in Israel with the soldiers, and he had a great, he only saw the good. He was really a Zionistic type person, not an official Zionist, but his philosophy was not something that the Haredi world would like to embrace. He would love to, he'd go to watch the children, parks and things like this, the Israeli children, the religious, the non-religious, didn't matter, because he is someone who saw children exterminated with his own eyes, including one of his own son. He did survive the war with his wife and a daughter. He was in Crown Heights for a while, teaching at Lubavitch, but there's a person in Lakewood, his name is Taplin, he published a number of things, and he was very close to Rav Gusman, and he published this book. And it's all what he heard from Rav Gusman. And in the introduction, he tells us a lot about Gusman, who joined the Basin, who's on the Basin. I think he was 22 years old. So you hear a lot here about Rav Chaim Moser. But he talks about how Rav Chaim Moser's wife in the ghetto, that Rav Gusman actually lying on the street at home, and he would bring food to her. Now to go into the whole story, I think I'll have a class maybe on Rav Gusman in the future. I'll get into it in more detail. Rabbi in Love from Yeshiva Chol Vei Torah was a big student of Rav Gusman. He studied with him in Israel, and Gusman actually repeat the story. I don't know if it was Purim every year, but he would repeat the story about how he, with his own bare hands, killed a Nazi. That might mean he killed a soldier. I don't know, because he went to the woods. I found something interesting about it. I was going through this book because it's on Aruch Chaim and all sorts of stuff. And I love books like this because they bring back to us, they recreate the world of the yeshivas. What life was like in, Lithuania. Was it Lithuania out anymore? It doesn't exist anymore, Lithuania. And the people who stay there from Lithuania, again, Lithuania doesn't exist anymore. So in addition, you get a sense of what it was like, the ethos of the yeshivas. But even quite apart from that, just the customs, which I find fascinating. For example, if you look on this book on page 117, Gusman tells us that in the Lithuanian yeshivas, they used to sit down for Vayivarech David and for Yishtabach. And only in Baruch Shamar and the Kaddish after Yishtabach, they would stand up. Now, I don't know. In my whole life, I don't think I've ever seen this practice of people sitting down for Yishtabach. And yet here we have, so Rav Gusman telling us that this was the practice in the Lithuanian yeshivas. And you have other examples of things that that he would do. I mean, the Shulchan Aruch says, if I'm not mistaken, the Ramah says you do stand. He says it right here, actually, that Ramah says you do stand for Yishtabach. But that wasn't the practice in the yeshiva belt. So if anyone's ever seen that, please let me know. Now, let me basically run out of time. Just one more minute. What we're going to do next time is, I want to show you something that I think is quite interesting. Chaim Moser, in addition to be the leader of the Jewish world, he was also the most significant posek of his day. Yet in terms of posterity, there are only a couple of tshuvot that have remained significant. And we'll talk about them next class. I don't think we're going to go, I don't know if we'll spend the whole next class on the final, or we might finish, or we might go the whole class. There's a lot to do. We have to deal with attitude towards Zionism and pending state of Israel. But I do think it's interesting that a posek who was so significant, in terms of posterity, he only has a couple to vote that today remain part of the discussion, the conversation. And one of them, which we'll have to look in detail, is his response among conversion. I don't think there's any question that his most important tshuva is his response among conversion, a very liberal approach to what we expect of future converts, an approach that has been totally thrown out by the Haredi world today. We will look at that, also look at his response among gelatin, and as well as something he has to say about birth control, but something similar to that. And as I said, then we'll move on to other issues, right? Zionism and separatism. The Aguda approach to separatism, did Rav Chaim Moser share it? Chazon Ish. And I don't think we'll get to him next time, but if not, certainly the time after, we will move on to the next figure in our series. Picture, just so you get ready for this. Rabbi Elijah ben Amozik, great Italian sage. Let me just show you his picture. Here we have, that's his book, not him. Because we're going to return to Italy again. Maybe I don't have a picture of him. Ah, here he is. Rabbi Eliel ben Amozig. Looks very different than the Lithuanian Rosh Hashiva, the Rafai Moser, that look. We've already dealt with Italy, with Yisrael Moshe Chazan. We returned to really, I think the last fascinating figure from Italy. Not just I think, actually, I know. The last person in Italy that you can describe as a posek. The last great biblical scholar, the last Makubal. Eliel ben Amozig is the last Makubal of Italy. Not only the last Makubal of Italy, the last great defender of Kabbalah. So if we don't get to him next class, we'll get to him certainly less after that. Okay. The book says that it just describes how Rav Gussman would bring food to her. He found her basically just dying on the street. And so we know that she was alive when the Holocaust was going on. And other than that, I wouldn't really know about her. So obviously we could say she was killed in the Holocaust. Yes, I will discuss next class the tshuva about using a condom. I'm trying to be use a little, as I say, Lashon Nekiyah. And not only that, I didn't get a chance to say it today, so I'll say it next class. This tshuva about using a condom, which many people will be very surprised. I myself have heard at least one rabbi state what, quote, Judaism's position is about using a condom. And I said to someone afterwards, that's really interesting that this rabbi tells us what halacha is and what Judaism's position is, because Rav Chaim Moser would be interested. I think we should, unfortunately, can't tell Rav Chaim Moser what Judaism's position is, because Rav Chaim Moser didn't know what Judaism's position was, because he had a completely different position than this pulpit rabbi who was able to declare what Judaism says. But in this sefer, you will see that Rav Mordechai Eliyahu agrees with Rav Chaim Moser and against that rabbi who I'll mention, able to tell the congregation what Judaism holds. And I'm sure you've all heard the news today that Rav Mordechai Eliyahu, not that old, only 81 years old, passed away today. Have to certainly do classes about him. It's always a question, what do you do when you're in a shul or something and say the rabbi says something which is just totally wrong? You know it's wrong, not that you think it's wrong. I never will say publicly, I won't raise my hand and ask and point this out, because I think it's humiliating, it's embarrassing to the rabbi. Some people, I know their attitude is if it's ain't cloaking kavod or rav. You can't give kavod in a situation like that, because the people heard something mistaken. You need to correct it. And if the rabbi is embarrassed, he shouldn't be embarrassed. Not everyone knows. No, who knows everything? I don't agree with that. I think the proper approach is you tell the rabbi privately, and then it's up to him. Next week he can correct himself. And if someone's not there and doesn't hear the correction, okay, it's not the worst thing in the world. But I don't think it's right to embarrass a rabbi, especially if a rabbi is so certain and saying that under no circumstances whatsoever could Judaism ever permit use of a condom. And for you to get up and say, well, excuse me, Rabbi, other rabbi who also, his name was Chaim Moshe Grzynski, had a different position on it. I just think that embarrasses the rabbi in front of the congregants and appropriate. But we will discuss that tshuva. The speech on Schiller, you go to yutorah.org. I don't know, can someone, Charles, maybe you can pull up a link very quickly. I don't know if you pull up my name. If it comes up, they usually have to connect the names. You can probably find it by the Torah Mata Journal, but maybe Charles Lander, in the next minute, he can pull up the link to it. Show her speech. Stay on one more minute. Comments. Oh, there it is. So not a tiny URL, but you can see, you can click on that. It'll take you there. Incidentally, it looks like a very interesting issue. Apparently, Gerald Blitstein's article is quite good. I'm told, I haven't read them yet. I just heard from the editor. Yoel Finkelman, his attack, his response to Meir Soloveitchik's piece. If you read Meir Soloveitchik, you really get what we call the theocons. Meir Soloveitchik, like his friend Klinghoffer out in Seattle, they basically bought into the whole, I'm not going to say the evangelical, but the whole First Things, if you know the journal First Things, the conservative Christian perspective on matters. Quite interesting, I'm sure, but I don't know. I think that sometimes when we buy into that, we leave some of our own views behind. If you look at Meir Soloveitchik's lecture at Torah Motion, for example, his opposition to selling organs. He reads like it's just out of the conservative playbook, not out of our halachic sources. So I have a lot of problems with some of what this very brilliant person, Meir Soloveitchik, says on a number of issues. You can hear on the University of Wisconsin website his talk about torture, which is a very interesting talk. And also you can read in First Things. This is where he first came to the public eye. His article, his famous article, The Virtue of Hate. And look at the issue a couple issues later, and you get the response to him from some of the people at YU. So he's definitely, as I said, when he came to the University of Scranton, I didn't call him an iconoclast. I called him I forgot the term I used for him, but one who basically challenges conventions, and we always need people like that. Certainly, in terms of public intellectuals, I think it's fair to say, not to speak about Jonathan Sacks, he's in England. I think it is fair to say that in the Orthodox world, we really have no public intellectuals. So believe it or not, Meir Soloveitchik, who I guess is about 35 years old, maybe 36, or I don't think much older, he, after Michael Wischegrod, I think Meir Soloveitchik might be the most distinguished public intellectual in the Orthodox world. And being that he's only 35 or so, that doesn't say, it shows you that Orthodoxy, that says, doesn't say very much for Orthodoxy, because even though he is brilliant, the fact that we don't have people much older and more distinguished says something about Orthodoxy today. But he obviously is an up-and-coming person, and as I said, I think it's fair to say that right now, he is, correct me if I'm wrong, if I'm missing someone, I think he is probably the second most distinguished public intellectual in Orthodoxy today. Obviously, the Reform movement, the Conservative movement have many such people, but in terms of Orthodoxy, people who try to change the culture, who interact as an Orthodox, not a person who happens to be Orthodox, but as, from the standpoint of Orthodoxy, as a spokesman in the public sphere, in the public arena, sort of like what David Novak does, obviously. He's a representative, I wouldn't say he's a representative of conservative Judaism, but he's not really what we call, he's not, quote, Orthodoxy. I believe I'm correct about Meir Soloveitchik in that. What does the Chazon Ish have to do with Chaim Grada? Only that Chaim Grada was Chazon Ish's Talmud. I don't know if the Chazon Ish had any other students in Eastern Europe. When he came to Israel, he had a number of students because people would just come and study with him. But obviously Shlomo, let me recommend you read the book The Yeshiva, two volumes. Here you will get, as Professor Tversky, my teacher, said, although it's a novel, you get the best description of the Chazon Ish ever written. Sometimes novels can be the best description. Chaim Grada was the Chazon Ish's great, great student, and then Chaim Grada breaks with the Chazon Ish, because Chaim Grada decides to abandon the road of Orthodoxy, and Chaim Grada would never go to the land of Israel when the Chazon Ish was there, because he knew he'd have to go visit him. So yes, so Ayin Grata was the Talmud of the Chazon Ish before. I see Charles Lander is typing. I don't know if you're typing for us, you're just typing in general. So I'll hold off for one more minute before I say goodnight to everyone. Okay, yeah, the way it works is I believe if you're signed on and if you're typing to check out another website or whatever, it shows you as typing, not necessarily typing to say anything to us. But I hope you everyone found tonight enjoyable, interesting. Email me any of your questions, and Bill Gewirtz, I will look into this and get back to you and get back next week about the business of Beit Charoshet. I'll have all the facts with me, God willing, when we meet next week. Good night, everyone.